welcome you all to this the latest History Ireland Head Scoop. My name is Tommy Graham, editor of History Ireland, and I hope you all have your complimentary copy there in front of you. That is, of course, on the basis that you will all subscribe before proceedings are up later. Now, just to explain a little bit about the format of the Head School, I can see you're all sitting very comfortably there, but don't get too comfortable, though, because one of the key features of the Head School is audience participation. So we will be expecting you all to contribute in various ways to discussion, but we'll come back to that later. It's a great pleasure to be here. It's the first time I've been in Ockram, incidentally. I've passed it on the road many a time, but it's the first time I've actually come in and had a look around. I called in yesterday and had a look at the centre, which is a marvellous facility. So we are here, of course. Ockram Remembered is the overall theme of the weekend. But the theme of the Head School here today is From Jacobitism to Jacobinism, a Reconsideration. Now, I just want to give a few, a few definitions here, just so everyone knows what we're talking about here. By Jacobitism, we are referring to support for the Stuart monarchy, 17th, 18th century, and possibly beyond, and its associated ideology. Now, I'm sure many of the panel are going to come back and redefine or tweak that definition, but just to get things going. By Jacobinism, that is basically shorthand for Irish republicanism. Jacobinism, of course, relates to the French Revolution. But what we will be exploring then is the transition, if you like, from Jacobitism, which on the face of it is a royalist, monarchical view of the world, to a republican view of the world. And again, on the face of it, this seems to be a complete contradiction. And that's one of the issues we will be exploring. Is it really a contradiction? But more on that later. Now, to discuss this, we have here, starting on my left, Hiram Morgan, who lectures in history in UCC, author of Tyrone's Rebellion, and incidentally one of the founders and indeed the inspirers of the History Ireland magazine. And then next to him here, we have Pádraig Lenihan of UCG. By the way,
University
Galway. NUI Galway. I beg your pardon.
We still call it UCC.
NUI Galway. But UCC kept UCC. Yeah, why did it? Anyway, we'll have a head school on that. Billy Kelly, of course, is on the program, but Billy couldn't make it due to a last-minute family commitment. But Pádraig is author of Consolidating Conquest. That's one of those Longman's survey histories. Pádraig, of course, is a military historian. And then to my right, another military historian, Richard Doherty, author of The Williamite War in Ireland and The Siege of Derry. And I'd just like to clarify the gross slander contained in the notes here that he's from Derry, or even Londonderry. He's in fact a Tyrone man. Let's get all this. Let's get the controversy out of the way early. And then, of course, finally, we have on my right, Eamon O'Keara at the University of Ulster. And I think Eamon, I suppose, could be described as the person closest to the coalface in terms of recent research on this topic. He's author of Ireland and the Jacobite Cause. Now, just to get things moving, get things started here, Richard, I'll come to you. We always start head schools with an easy question. Could you sum up the Battle of Ockram for me in about 2 minutes? We are here in Ockram. If you just give us in broad brushstrokes, what actually happened? Why are we commemorating this event?
I'm merely tempted to start quoting Dominic Bean on that one and just say about two foreign monarchs in battle to join, but it's the wrong battle, isn't it? This was the bloodiest day in Irish history, 12th of July, 1691. And it's celebrated every year in Northern Ireland by the Orange Men, even though they think they're celebrating the Battle of the Boyne, but it's actually the Battle of Ockram that the celebrations began for. Basically, you've got an Irish army that's on the retreat, it's into Connacht, and you've got a Williamite army that is pursuing it and trying to finish off the business of the war in Ireland. William of Orange had failed to finish it the previous year and had gone back to England a little bit, I think, discontented, particularly with John Churchill, who had done much better than William had done. the first Duke of Marlborough. And William, of course, was also very unhappy with his English soldiers. So very large part of the Williamite army that's fighting in Ireland in 1691 is, in fact, from the continent. So you've got Danish soldiers, which we're going to hear about later, as well as English soldiers. So you've got a right mixture. And you've got Godard de Ginkel, who becomes the first Baronet Lone commanding an army. The Irish army is very largely Irish. It's a new unit, it's a relatively young army. It's not all that well trained, although it's got an awful lot of officers and commanders who are well trained, who have a lot of experience and know what they're doing. It's under the command of the Marshal General of Ireland, Marshal Saint Roux, a Frenchman, an extremely arrogant Frenchman, who fails in the planning stages to let his other senior officers know what today would be known as the commander's intent. And that might not have been a problem had not Saint Roux quite literally lost his head in the course of the battle. Ginkel was a very slow and plodding general. If you're looking for a 19th century comparison to General McClellan in the American Civil War, if you're looking for a 20th century comparison, General Bernard Montgomery of 8th Army fame and 21 Army Group in Northwest Europe, both are similar in many ways to Ginkel. So this man takes a long time getting moving. The Jacobite army is well positioned. Saint Roux has positioned it quite well. He's got the advantage of good ground. He's got the advantage of covering any particular any points or routes of access that the enemy might have. He's also very much aware of the fact that this Irish army is, not totally raw, but it hasn't had the experience, it hasn't had the training, it hasn't had the drill to be able to carry out all the battlefield evolutions that a continental army could. And therefore it's fighting very largely from behind cover. From behind cover it's going to do very well and does do very well. And that's the early part of the battle where the Irish are in the ascendancy. And unfortunately for the Irish, as we all know, it all goes very, very badly wrong. And in a sense, aren't we always like this? We look for a scapegoat. Somebody sold the pass, and you know, the scapegoat is necessary. The Irish are finally beaten by the skill and the eye for ground of some, but not all, of the officers on the Williamite side. One in particular, Scotsman Mackay, who is a cavalry commander who realises exactly what it is that Saint Roux's plan is, simply from the positioning of his soldiers, particularly his cavalry. And it's that coming together of the appreciation of the ground of Mackay. Then that sort of happenstance that does happen in battle, the fact that the soldiers at one point run out of ammunition, the fresh ammunition that they're given doesn't fit their muskets, it's the wrong size, it won't fit in. So they end up firing their coat buttons, they end up firing their ramrods, they end up firing all sorts of things. So at the end of the day, it literally is a case of the enemy, the Williamite cavalry, getting in and starting to move in from the flank. And once that happens, the Jacobite soldiers really are left with the choice of fight or flight. And that's as short a summary as I can give of the battle.
I think, Tommy, also,
yes, I am, yeah.
It would be useful to say that the remarkable thing about the Battle of Aughrim, I think, is that this is a European battle. Not only Ireland's largest and most bloody battle, but it's a European battle fought on Irish soil. Like, really, it's part of a wider contest between Louis XIV and William of Orange, who's leading this League of Augsburg against the absolutist and expansionist monarchy of France under Louis XIV. And William has assembled a remarkable alliance, the German Emperor and indeed the Pope, all of whom are cheesed off at the expansionism. Like, basically, the Pope's territory at Avignon had recently been overrun even by Louis XIV. Louis XIV has invaded the Rhineland. He has destroyed Heidelberg, one of the university towns of Europe, a bad idea to destroy a university town. Everybody gets annoyed about it. And William becomes leader of this alliance, and that's why William has to bring England into the picture as a further ally. And that's why William becomes so anxious to gain the English throne. And then consequently, the French send forces to support James here in Ireland. And like the remarkable thing is, like, this is even a proxy in French terms, because like the number two on the Williamite side is Ruvigny, a French Huguenot who's been turfed out of France 4 or 5 years before under the Edict of Nantes, and one of the men who led the persecution of the Huguenots was Saint Ruth, leader of the Irish army, who'd been quite vicious in the Savoy against Protestants there. So this is a universal conflict which is actually happening in Ireland, a very continental conflict happening in Ireland.
Paul, can I come back to you on the just to picking up where Richard left off there? So from what I gather from Richard, the Jacobite side could have won at Aughrim, possibly. And the point is, would it have made any difference, or were they going to be defeated anyway?
I'll answer that question after I draw a quick question to the audience. It's following on what Richard was saying, and I won't be long on it, but I will answer your question. Richard made the point that it's the biggest battle in Irish, the bloodiest day in Irish history. And it probably is, but not by much. Knockdoe, another battle in County Galway, half you haven't heard of. None of you have heard of Scariff Hollis up in Donegal, 1650. Maybe I'm doing Dungan's Hill, County Meath, 1647. Almost as many people die there, and relative to the sizes. The question is the act of remembering. Why do we remember certain things and forget? You know, forget not the field where they perished. They threw us to the last of the brave. Why do we, the people like Moore, commemorate Aughrim, and other things are forgotten? Now, that's just, I'm throwing that one out, I'm not answering it. To answer your question, just strictly speaking, one shouldn't answer it, because it's hypothetical or counterfactual. They didn't, so they didn't. Could they have won, or what would have happened? Yes, they could have won in the sense that they could have stopped. They had won, virtually, at one point. So they could have stopped Ginkle and driven them to retreat to Athlone. Could they have taken Athlone? Yes. Would that have made a difference? No, because the French were going to lose at sea next year. The entire Irish campaign depended on French ships being able to connect with Ireland, bring provisions and bring troops. So 1693, it could have been the Williamite Wars, 1689 to 92 rather than 91.
So what you say would have made very little difference
in the long term. No.
Could I link maybe your last 2 points, your little digression there, right? Which is, why do we commemorate failures? I just come back from the Titanic Centre in Belfast, a marvellous
place.
Yeah, a monument to failure. Like, if the Titanic hadn't hit that iceberg, nobody would be talking about the Titanic. And I'm just curious, if the Jacobites hadn't been defeated at Aughrim, you know, nobody would remember. If they'd won at Aughrim, would anyone be commemorating it? What is this fascination with failure?
There's a glamour in failure, in a certain kind of failure. There's no glamour in, as a Dungan's Hill or Scariff Hollis. That's just a one-sided, absolute botch on the Irish side. But Aughrim, there was bravery, there was sacrifice, there was defeat. Is it like Culloden or Gettysburg? It has its own glamour.
It's a near close run thing. I think it's that nearness to victory,
yeah.
but not quite.
Hiram, I'll come back to you in a second, Aaron.
Okay.
Don't go away, as the fellow said. Hiram, before we get on to the legacy of Aughrim and the whole, you know, Jacobite legacy of the 18th century, I would like just to give maybe a bit of the backstory, because, you know, the first Jacobite monarch of Scotland and England was James I, who's James II's, is he grandfather or father? Sorry,
grandfather.
And, you know, strictly speaking, you know, also comes under the term Jacobite. And then, of course, Charles I, with whom the Catholic Irish allied during the time of Cromwell, and that had disastrous consequences. You think, you know, that the Catholics of Ireland would have learned their lesson. Like, I mean, if they got hammered by Cromwell for supporting Charles I, as Oscar Wilde would have said, it demonstrates carelessness to support his son, James II. How can that be explained?
Well, in fact, you really don't have very much option. But the first instance is why do the Irish support a Scottish Protestant king, James I, in the first instance?
Yeah.
And that is because he's descended from the Irish line of kings, the Milesian kings of Ireland. So the Irish courts and the Irish elite and aristocracy decide that they should support the Stuarts as the national monarchy of Ireland. And this is a story made famous by the work of the late Brendan O'Buchla, his work on Jacobinism in the 17th century, which shows how a lot of the Irish hoped that the Stuart monarchy would be their salvation. Of course, that turned out to be otherwise. James I continued to persecute Irish Catholics. His son Charles, crucially, married a Catholic. That's what endangered him with the English Protestant elite and indeed with the Scottish one. Because of the marriage to Henrietta Maria, really, that was as a result of that, that the second son, James, I suppose, ends up a Catholic. He turns Catholic when the family are evicted and on the continent. His elder brother, I suppose, has a deathbed conversion to Catholicism, allegedly. But at that stage, by the late 17th century, the Stuarts are really the only salvation of the Irish in the sense that the monarch taking over as a Catholic monarch, he starts to reverse things. And he establishes a new army in Ireland, which becomes the basis of the army that fought here in Aughrim. And then once he's ejected from England, you have the Patriot Parliament in Ireland, which then starts to reverse the land changes of Cromwell. So they had great hopes for James, but, well, of course, the thing is, James obviously let them down. Like, he scarpers pretty pronto from the Boyne, and, like, he's apparently in Dublin before most of the retreating army, and he's at Conseil pretty quickly thereafter to leave the country. So, the Jacobites are their only hope, and from the Protestant point of view, especially after James has a Catholic son late in life with a wife who previously hadn't borne any children, then suddenly there is a promise of a Catholic dynasty of Jacobites, that the Stuart monarchy, which had been Protestant for 100 years, will now become a Catholic monarchy, and that they eventually die a Catholic monarchy in Rome.
Ian, I want to bring you in here, but I tell you, I red lights come with me straight away because people are referring to the Irish, right? Who are the Irish? Who are we talking about here? Maybe, Ian, you could.
Well, I think of the group that supports James, there are, you know, the Irish who of the groups who support, there are three groups. One small but very the Irish Protestant Jacobite is a very rare species, but he's hugely important. You know, somebody like Charles Leslie, the Monaghan-born Anglican clergyman, probably the most influential evangelist of English Jacobites. He writes a famous rejoinder, a devastating rejoinder to what is, if you like, the Protestant Bible of this period. Bishop King's State of the Protestants in Ireland under the late King James of Dublin, which is essentially his way of, abrogating Protestant responsibility for actually breaking their oath. Because people in the 17th century took oaths very seriously. They had all taken an oath of loyalty to James, and even though James was a Catholic, even though he had in their eyes made certain mistakes, he had appointed people to, if you like, rule on his behalf, notably Dick Talbot in Ireland, he was still the king, an oath had been taken to him. So the Protestant Jacobite group is small, but it's important and it's influential. Then there are two other groups. In Irish, there are the Sean Ghael, or the Old Irish, and the Sean Ghael, the Old English. And even though these two, if you like, groups were coalescing from the 1640s. There's still a sense of that division in the 1670s. And this is probably best exemplified if you look at two of the probably the most important surviving Irish Catholic accounts of the war, Charles O'Kelly's Mac Carey Exeed and the Destruction of Cyprus. It's an allegorical Hiberno-Latin account of the war, and it's written by an O'Kelly, and it's very much from an old Irish perspective. And then there's Nicholas Plunkett, and Nicholas Plunkett would have been a Pales man from Mother County Meath. He writes a long account called A Light to the Blind and a series of pamphlets which were never published. So they are the three groups. One group is small, but it's important, and it becomes increasingly important when James is in exile, because it's after the 18th century, the Duke of Ormond, the James Butler, second Duke of Ormond, would go into exile in 1715. Swift is not a Jacobite, but he certainly he sails close to the wind. Some of his friends, like the Lord Mayor of London, a man called John Bright, another one of his friends, one of the Sheridans of County Cavan, lost a benefice for, you know, his if you like, Jacobite fellow travelling. So there's these three groups, two Catholic, they're the prominent groups, and they represent, if you like, the main components of
Irish I want to come back to what I wanted to actually ask you about was you know, gay poetry and so on. I'll come back to that, because hold that thought for a second, because I want to talk about something else, and you've already touched on it now. That's the fact that you had Protestant Jacobites in Ireland. There was a strong Jacobite tradition in Scotland. There would have been a Jacobite tradition in England itself. So what I'd like to throw out, Jacobitism is normally discussed in the context of Irish nationalism. But are we in fact talking here about a British ideology, Pádraic?
No, not at all. Again, I'd hesitate to disagree with Eamon about the... I think the old English Gaelic-Irish distinction is pretty academic by the 1690s. Or it's not as important as heretofore. I mean, when you look at people, look at Lord Galway, what's his name, Ulrich Burke, his mother's a McCarthy, Sarsfield, his mother is an O'Moore. What is he? English, old English Gaelic-Irish? Hell, he doesn't know. I mean, he's an Irish Catholic. Catholic means Irish. That's the blunt, I think, lesson of the 17th century. But of course, there are the Charles Leslies and the always for historians. We're always been caught by the exceptions, and they're interesting. But to answer your question, Vincent Morley would argue in a famous, well-known rejoinder to Sean Connolly, he would say that it's the themes of Irish Jacobitism. Jacobitism is in Britain a Protestant ideology. In Scotland and in England, but in Ireland it's a Catholic ideology, and it's related to Gaelic thinking and Gaelic aspirations to a great extent. So as such, it articulates a language of dissent which would be obnoxious to British Jacobites. So in that sense,
but isn't there a paradox in that? Will the Tories get their name? It's almost a slur on them, connecting them up with Ireland. And their Jacobinism, in a sense, which was
Jacobitism.
To at least supporting the regime of Queen Anne. Then they had to make a choice when there's no longer a Stuart monarchy, when the Georges come in. Until then, you could say there is an English Jacobite ideology. But once the Georges are in, and once James III has stayed a Catholic, and English Toryism is really much more attenuated than Jacobitism.
I remember Eamon had a quote there one time about the English, the Scottish, and the Irish, and was it the English drank for Jacobitism and
the hold on a second. The Irish dreamed about Jacobitism, the English drank, and the Scots fought. But of course, that's, you know, it's a flippant comment which is actually inaccurate. If you think that in the 17th century, one could argue that more Irishmen died for the House of Stuart than Scotsmen. And I think the term British is deeply problematic to use in the context of Jacobites, at least in the Three Kingdoms, because most Jacobites and many Tories who weren't Jacobite were totally opposed to the union of the crowns. Many many Protestant Highland families would have been opposed to the union. The Stuarts, after all, were a Scottish dynasty that had been established courtesy of Mel Gibson in the 14th century, and they had ruled Scotland, arguably the most unlucky family to ever sit on a throne.
This is the Scottish-English Union, 1707.
Which they were opposed, when and essentially Queen Anne, the union of the crowns of England and Scotland in 1707, was an attempt to stifle a Jacobite invasion in 1708. There was a feeling that Anne had been predeceased by her 19 children. The next in line to the throne after 1701, the Act of Succession, King Billy, before he died, put the Act of Succession through Parliament, which meant that a Catholic could not succeed to the throne of England, Scotland or Ireland. The 52nd in line to the throne was the Elector of Hanover, a man called George Guelph. So there was a fear that if James landed in Scotland, that he'd actually hold what had been the traditional kingdom.
Now, I want to just move away maybe from ideology back to the nuts and bolts of the battlefield, because that's where ideology counts, if you like. And Richard, I want to bring you in here, and the other lads can come in as well. And we're moving beyond the defeat at Aughrim. And that is, and the question is, how credible was the Jacobite threat in the 18th century? Give me a two-minute answer. I think this is very central to the whole history of the 18th century, in particular the penal laws, for example. And also the question of although the Jacobites were defeated in Ireland, they were still a military threat elsewhere.
Well, I've actually just finished editing a book for a Scottish historian called The Killing Fields of Scotland, which will be published by Pen and Sword Books early next year, folks, if you want to have a look at it. And having read that, I don't actually think that Scottish Jacobitism was a real threat. There's an awful lot of romance talked about Bonnie Prince Charlie. I don't know how bonny he was, but he certainly wasn't a very nice person. Certainly wasn't a capable military leader. He threw his men into a massive kamikaze attack at Culloden. And I think the Scots despaired of it after that. Having said that, I can give you one echo, and it actually touches on something that Parik said earlier about Scottish Jacobitism. I wrote a book some years back on the 51st Highland Division in the Second World War. While I was researching it, I came across some background information to a victory parade that was held in Tripoli in Libya in February 1943. Parade actually my father was in. The Highland Division took part in it, and all their pipers and all their drummers had to come together as mass pipes and mass drums to actually lead the parade.
This is all happening in the desert of North Africa.
Yeah.
All this Scottish stuff in the desert.
And they cannot agree. There are five Highland regiments, two of which are Campbell and three of which are Jacobite. And the Campbells won't play Jacobite tunes and the Jacobites won't play Campbell tunes. Can you imagine the noise those pipes made in Tripoli?
Eamon, you come in there. You would descend from that.
Yeah,
you would see the Jacobite.
I think that if we look at the debacle of Culloden with the omniscient benefit of hindsight, we can see that it was an abject failure. But this, essentially Italian prince lands in Scotland in 1745. Within the space of 6 months, he has captured Aberdeen, Glasgow. He's taken Edinburgh, except the castle, and he subsequently marches to within 100 miles of London. There's a run on the Bank of England. King George is forced to bring two regiments back from Flanders, where they're sorely needed in the War of the Austrian Succession. So, we know now what happened. But Bonnie Prince Charlie did manage to recruit a bigger army than the army that Henry VII defeated Richard III at Bosworth in 1485, or is it 1484? I defer to the Tudor historians here. But and similarly in Ireland, when you think in 1689, William arrives in 1690. You know, he has an army of hardened European veterans at his back. He's bankrolled to the tune of 2 billion sterling in modern money by the English Parliament. As Porrick has, you know, Britannia rules the waves. But still, he's bogged down here for 3 years. He's forced. He has an army here that is desperately needed on the continent. This is at a time when his adversary, Marshal Luxembourg, or as he was known, Le Tapissier de Notre Dame, the decorator of Notre Dame, is sweeping every Habsburg army off the field on the continent. So William doesn't want to be stuck in England, and he certainly doesn't want to be stuck in Ireland. So the other thing, of course, is that, you know, James did, for all his psychological and personal problems, James was himself, he had a great reputation as a soldier and as a sailor. He had fought with Marshal Turenne, probably the greatest soldier of 17th century France, and he is a man that has all the I'm a doctor of philosophy, not of medicine, but he is a man that has all the symptoms of a psychological breakdown. He doesn't want to be in Ireland. He certainly doesn't want to be leading an army. But in spite of all the material and political advantages, you know, this war lasts for 3 years. And I suppose, touching on the point that Poetic made at the outset, and Hiram endorsed it essentially, what's significant about Aughrim is it's the close run thing. This is where one man loses in his head and it changes the course of the battle. At least that's what people believe. It's also a conflict that is seared into the Irish psyche. It's the wounded knee of Gaelic Ireland. It's Aughrim of the slaughter.
Can I just interject there quickly, because this has been referred to several times, the slaughter, right?
Yeah.
What exactly were the casualties? Maybe, Richard, you come in on that, the casualties at Aughrim.
Well, the accepted figure is 7,000, but that's open to challenge, and I think Parry would challenge it. I've told earlier today that another source has recently claimed as much as 9,000.
9,000 on the Jacobite side? Or
9,000 in total.
How does that break down, Jacobite, Williamite?
I'm not sure what the breakdown is, Jacobite, Williamite, on the 9,000.
I'd be inclined to, as Richard was saying, put it at, I'm not trying to diminish Aughrim, I think about 3,500 Jacobites or Irish were killed or taken prisoner at Aughrim. That is still a lot of people.
Yep. I didn't want to stop your flow there. Do you want to continue or will I?
I just
wanted to clarify the thing of the slaughter, right?
Just to endorse what Clowden says. 3,500 was the same amount of people that was killed on 9/11, right? The United States of America has a population of 300 million. Ireland would have had a population of less than, less than 1.5 million.
1.5, less than that.
So these are eye-watering casualties in a small country. Then, you know, the Tour of Horlea de Gonal, you know, Seamus Dalmacurta's lament for Sorley MacDonald, who was killed, you know, and it's that where that phrase, Aughrim on Oyer, Aughrim of the slaughter. The fact that a poet in South Armagh is writing about a man who died, one of the MacDonalds of Antrim, shows that there were people from all over Ireland there.
Yeah, could I just interject here? Did this cut a swathe then through the Catholic aristocracy the same way as the terror did in revolutionary France?
Absolutely.
You're losing 32 battalion commanders, colonels, 17 are killed or taken prisoner. The people who are killed disproportionately are the people, are the leadership. And in a hierarchical society, leaders matter a lot. So your Lord Galway's or your Boffins or your Sarsfields or people of Kilmallock, people like that, that they matter. Incidentally, there's also the slaughter is given more vivid because of the fact that the bodies unusually are not buried. They're not buried for weeks afterwards. The bodies are collected by the friars of Kilconnell and they're erected into a wall 88 foot long and 4 foot high that remains there. It disintegrates over the 18th century. And in Lord Clonbrock in the 1860s, buried the bodies somewhere in the vicinity. I'd love an archaeologist to go and look and find out where
they're probably going to load over.
Ah, stop.
Because Sir Thomas Molyneux has an account of his visit to Offrim, where local people brought him over and showed him skulls and said, you know, that is such and such a person, this is the son of the Earl of Clanricarde, this is... So people, you know, local people knew exactly who the remains were.
By the way, there was a particular type of moss that only grew in skulls. But the point was, the moss was only good if it was skulls that were killed, you know, accidentally, right, i.e. in battle. So apparently the apothecaries were coining it in Ireland because they had a huge supply of this particular moss. Yeah. I read that in History Ireland, by the way. So I'll check it up.
No, I was going to interject here about our National Battlefields Project.
Yes, Adam, yes, take the podium.
Like the archaeology there will be key to that if it eventually gets established. Because one of the problems in Ireland is that battle sites aren't historic monuments as such. Like, the battle site of Boyne is a novelty in that regard. But battle sites don't have monument status, and therefore they can't be protected against development. So consequently, one of the objects of our National Battlefield Project is actually to survey battle sites and prepare, ultimately, legislation to protect battle sites for their tourist benefit that they might have. And this one's a unique one because a lot of the landscape still exists, as very much many of the ditches and hedges, enclosures were starting at that point. So many of these still exist, and many of the morasses and bogs around are still more or less in the same place. So this landscape is still intact. And one of the things is that not only will this survey establish where exactly battles were, but also designate areas to conserve, and consequently then, once there is development threatened, that there will be proper archaeology done and proper recovery and examination of finds. And so the stuff that Corrick's talking about here, about where the corpses are buried, about where crucial incidents of the battle happened, where Solruth's head was carried off, etc., etc., and even just behind us here, the new motorway revealed more or less where Luttrell's retreat happened, or somewhere in that vicinity. Even there, Porrick thinks it's a good 200 or 300 yards before, behind where Luttrell actually was, but still there was stuff there to be found during the motorway development. So consequently, in this area and, you know, further that direction, goodness knows what could be found with proper metal detecting and proper archaeology, in tandem with the historical documents and the narrations, etc., etc., the contemporary documentation about the battle, of all that can be brought together, and then it can feed into the tourist product, etc., etc.
Now, Eamon.
Just about Luttrell was assassinated in Dublin in 1713, right? And the United Irishman took his skull out and smashed it with a hatchet in, what was it, 1797 or 8. You know, there's a nice little lead from Jacobinism to Jacobinism.
Well, can I be even more provocative now? The Battle of Aughrim and Treaty of Limerick secured peace for 100 years. Ireland had not had peace for 100 years under the Protestant ascendancy. What about that?
Well,
and prosperity for 100 years.
I tell you, that relates to the question I'm just about to ask Eamon, right, Hiram, which is, Eamon, you just mentioned the 45 there, pointing to his charges of invasion of Scotland and England. And then there was another scare in 1715, right? Now, if Jacobitism was as strong an ideology as you claim in your book in Ireland, how come nothing much happened in Ireland in support of either of those Jacobite scares?
Well, I think there's a couple of fundamental reasons for that. I think that the effectiveness of the penal legislation, of the systematic disarming of Catholics. The same thing, of course, would be, you know,
America ought to have some penal legislation.
Absolutely. But, you know, subsequently the British state learned its lesson after 1745 and did exactly the same. It ran massive this is why I would disagree with the opinion that the book that you were reading, the idea that the 45 wasn't important. If you look at what happens, the Duke of Cumberland basically commits what Alan McGuinness would exaggerate as genocide in the Highlands after the 45. They run massive big military roads and build military installations. They disarm the Highlanders, prescribe the tartan. That was effective. The penal, the disarming of Catholics was effective, first. Secondly, there was a feeling in, at the Jacobite court, be it in Saint-Germain, be it in Avignon, or where they ended up in Rome, was that Catholic Ireland was loyal to the Stuarts, but they did not have the wherewithal to raise a rebellion unless, officers and arms and men were sent. And this never happened.
But Eamon, is there another obvious explanation, which is they got hammered twice before, and they weren't going to make the same mistake a third or fourth time.
You could say the same of the Jacobite War itself. They'd been hammered at the beginning of, at the end of the 16th century. They were hammered from 1641 to 1652. But within the space of 20 years, Tyrconnell had prepared Jacobite Ireland for war, and despite the relatively poor state of the Irish economy, despite their lack of arms and despite the country's lack of, the sinews of war, they did reasonably well in the circumstances. So I don't accept that argument that they...
I hate to be agreeing for once, but the Navy stopped the French landing an army. If the French had landed an army, yeah. I mean, they landed at... In going to 1798, they landed Killala with, 1700? Mm-hmm. Was it even there?
A thousand.
Yeah. And that made it, and the response to that was huge. If they could have got bodies on the ground, and why weren't they able, we won't go into it, but they weren't able to get, beat British naval dominance.
No, weren't the French able to land far more people in Ireland in the 1690s than they ever were in the 1790s?
But that was only for 2 years. There was a window where the French actually had a decent navy. Right. Richard, would that be correct?
That would be true, but I'd have to say that the French navy at the period that we're looking at actually was a decent navy. The problem was it was split into two fleets, Mediterranean fleet, the Atlantic fleet. The French aristocracy were more concerned about the beautiful decoration of their ships than about their effective manning and use in war. And you not only had the Royal Navy, which actually had almost ceased to exist at the time of the deposing of James II. Yes. There was no trust at all in William, and it needed, and you look through the London Gazette at the time, and it took quite some time for them to get the Royal Navy back to what it had been. And it's only because you've got brutally effective officers.
But also at this battle at Porricks, referred to La Hogue in Normandy, it's a Dutch navy as well.
Well
that's the key point.
To come on to you see, it's actually not just the Royal Navy, yes. It's the Royal Navy and the Dutch Navy. Sure. And if the French had got themselves to draw the fleet out of the Mediterranean, but I don't think strategically they were ever going to do that. If you look at the Siege of Derry, for example, it would have made a huge difference if the French Navy had been used to bring siege guns into the Jacobite army outside Derry. Derry would never have lasted. And heaven alone only knows what our history would have looked like after that.
But the key thing there, as Park said, the destruction of people getting killed in the Williamite War, particularly at Aughrim, and then the departure of many members of the aristocracy to lead the Stuart regiments in the French army, which becomes the Irish Brigades, that means that there is no aristocratic leadership in Ireland of the Jacobite cause, and we're left then with a quiescent Catholic hierarchy. One of the unfortunate things with penal laws is that the people who start to run the country, the Catholic part of the country, is the Catholic hierarchy. That's one of the legacies of the Jacobite period, is that the Catholic hierarchy gained prominence in leadership positions that they hadn't.
Is that because they're the only show in town, basically?
More or less.
Yeah. that's a good point. And of course, they were themselves Stuart of Pinty, so
absolutely,
they were ideologically sound, but they weren't exactly...
Could you just be a bit more explicit on that, Eamon, just for the benefit of the audience? What was the role of the Stuart? These guys are in exile, right?
In 1685...
Control of nothing,
right? In 1685, when James II became king, he petitioned the Pope for the right to nominate bishops to Irish, English and Scottish Catholic sees, and the Pope acquiesced in that, as he did with his most Catholic Majesty, the King of France, and his most Christian.
Even though he later ends up on the opposing side of the war itself.
Absolutely, but the Stuart King nominated bishops. So if the Bishop of Clogher in my own diocese died, groups of priests would, or the surviving, if you like, aristocracy or gentry class, would write to the king, would write to James with nomination. James would decide who he would choose as bishop, and he would send that to the Pope. The Stuart king issued, a patent. He was nominating this man to rule this see. So from 1685 until the death of the last of the Stuart, to the death of James Francis Edward, the old pretender, James III, as he was known to Jacobite, of the 125 bishops that were nominated in Ireland in that period, only five of them were not nominated by this exiled Stuart. So because he nominated the bishops, because the Pope recognised him as the true king, as the de jure king of the three kingdoms, he wielded a lot of influence over the Catholic clergy and over the Catholic laity. And as Hyrum rightly puts it, there's no aristocracy.
But also, like, this is why Dean Swift can refer to the whole people of Ireland, meaning themselves, the Protestant upper classes.
Yeah.
Because basically the Irish have ceased to exist as a result of the Penal Laws as a political nation, as a political class.
And even to bring it home, as it were, Ockham is important there, because the Treaty of Limerick, oddly enough, Catholics could keep their lands, except for people who were killed in battle, their families, or people who were taken prisoner. And there was a big bag of prisoners and dead at Ockham. So that's a big loss of land. Even before you look at the Penal Laws, which are, I'm convinced, they're all about forcing the Irish Catholic upper classes to convert. That's what they're about. And they succeed. And if you convert people, they adopt the mores and the, if you like, the worldview of the ascendancy after a generation or two, or three perhaps. But that's what happens. So they're very, the laws are very, very successful.
Yeah, well, what you had is that when James comes back to power, you had the Catholics had about 20% of the land. After the Williamite War and the Treaty of Limerick, they had about 14% of the land. But as a result of Catholic conversions, the Irish Catholic land ownership basically halves to about 6 or 7% of the land. And so this negligible at that stage. And the key point is that land ownership denotes so much more. Because then you sit on juries, then you elect people to office. You're in Parliament, in the House of Lords, or electing people to the House of Commons. But that's, of course, put a stop to as well, Catholics being elected to the House of Commons. So consequently, land ownership is the key to political power.
Now, it seems to me then, though, that the result of all of this was that Catholics generally, regardless of class, had this huge millstone around their neck, i.e. association with this lost Jacobite cause. You know, maybe that's with hindsight I'm saying that, right? Because it meant then that any Catholic, by definition, then, was subversive. Therefore, the Penal Laws were justified from the point of view of the 18th century state. Now, I want to move on to the second part of our title here, which is Jacobinism, i.e. Irish, particularly Irish republicanism, which comes to the fore in the 1790s. Now, by that stage, the Jacobites have given up the ghost. In 1788, Charles Edward, Bonnie Prince Charlie, dies, and his next successor is a guy who sometimes styled Henry IX, who was a cardinal, so he didn't have any children. So what happens to it? What happens to it? And Eamon, I'd like you to come in here in particular, because this is what I'd like to discuss now, is you have the apparent contradiction that this royalist cause, this adherence to a royalist cause, disappears. And then we all become Republicans from the 1790s onwards.
Yeah, I think that, I suppose, the fundamental political, if you like, or constitutional legacy of the Glorious Revolution or Inglorious Rebellion, however one styles it or cares to look at it, is that Britain becomes a Protestant state. And in a sense, some of the legacy of that survives until the present day. I think David Cameron was talking about changing it, but ultimately, you know, the Prince of Wales or the Princess Royal cannot marry a Catholic. A Catholic cannot sit on the throne of England nor be Lord Chancellor. Tony Blair, well, was a Catholic in all but name until but the Prime Minister has not, you know, been Catholic. So one could say, or, you know, I would suggest that Catholic Ireland becomes the problem child of this Protestant state, and ultimately the seeds, and there is that idea of the, you know, the tree of liberty sprouted in France, its seeds fell in America, you know, or sorry, it sprouted in America, it grew in France, its seeds fell in Ireland, we're going to plant it into the crown of England. So the seeds of French republicanism germinate in the fertile soils of Irish Catholic discontent. That is not to say that there is not a, you know, and you can bring this right up to the middle of the 19th century. If you mention Mangan, you could mention Davis, you could mention Moore. In a sense, what these English, you know, they're writing through the media of English, they're recycling many of the Cainta and Marivna that was composed about Ockham or composed about 17th century Ireland, but they're disinfecting it of any reference to the Stuarts, and this will come to its, you know, apogee in you know, James Connolly in his Labour in Irish History famously refers to James as the most useless representative of the most useless race ever to sit on a throne. So there's a disavowal of Jacobitism and Irish Catholic royalism, but the vehicle is still used, and it's redirected towards a celebration and an articulation.
I think we have to interject there. One of the things is that the United Irishmen and the Jacobins are essentially a sort of minority Protestant tradition, and in particular a Presbyterian tradition. Like, the thing is that from the 1760s onwards to the 1790s, the Catholics were basically cozying up with the British government against the Protestant ascendancy in Ireland.
The
remarkable thing is that the British state, because it had grown into an empire, it needed Catholic soldiers.
Yeah.
And once the Jacobite cause collapses, once James III dies, there is this extraordinary turnabout in English attitudes to Irish Catholics, where suddenly they're needed for an army. And then suddenly England puts pressure on the Irish Parliament to give Catholic relief.
Maynooth, of course, is basically a bribe to the Catholic Church to keep Irish Catholics on side. However, when the United Irishmen forge a political and military alliance with Defenderism, that Defender ideology is very much a Janus-headed ideology. It's looking forward to, you know, a Republican utopia, but it's looking back at lands lost, it's looking back to the Jacobite legacy.
But you could say that on the one hand leads to Scullabogue and Wexford, and the Catholic militias of Western Ulster marching through the lines at Ballyhinch,
it's funny, O'Buchla recognised this, and from the 1760s onwards, there's a virulent anti-clerical element coming into what you might call plebeian Irish poetry. And he did suggest that that may have have something to do with the sense to which the Catholic hierarchy were seeking a strategic accommodation with the House of Hanover. They're attempting all sorts of, you know, verbal gymnastics to get around the various oaths that they can take to, you know, that they can take an oath of loyalty to King George without, if you like, without falling foul of, you know, the Roman Catholic Church. And it's only when James dies in 1766 that they really can, that they really can do that, because the Pope refuses to recognise Bonnie Prince Charlie.
This idea of a seamless transition from royalism to republicanism, it's, as you can see, it's a difficult one, because morally, people looking at the evidence, and when you look at a port, you'll find a port and you say, like, I was just preparing for today's talk, he was talking about one of these defender ports, I think in South Armagh or Dundalk in the 1790s, and he's talking about ni vien lishuk no riella Ostrohamokno, no, and I'm sure so. In other words, there won't be Louis or any more kings from now on. That seems radical republican and republican. Yet he's looking back to the broken treaty, the confiscation of lands, the coming of the Boers, and all these 18th century themes. I'm just going to throw out one that I don't have the answer to. And you know, with Jacobite and Jacobinism, Jacobite ideology, the Jacobite world is in Tipperary, Limerick, Cork. It's hugely a Munster word. It's very strong there. Why don't you have a 1798 rising in Munster? Why is it confined to the English-speaking areas, largely, of Ireland? Is there some sort of firewall? Sorry, was that a question you were going to put?
No.
Yeah. Is there a firewall between Jacobitism and Jacobinism, or is it?
Well, one of the things, 99% of United Irish propaganda was written in English. That's one explanation.
Yeah, but also, the poetry coming through into the 19th century, you know, celebrating the likes of Daniel O'Connell, the transformation into a sort of from the Stuarts to a, you know, the residual Catholic aristocracy. But like, basically, it seems to me that the defender tradition, etc., chooses popular Catholic democracy. They choose Daniel O'Connell rather than Tone and Drennan as their figures. You know, they basically choose the Charlie Hawkins of this world, you know, the chieftain, the heel fellow well meant, you know, and that's sort of what we don't want, you know. That's what we end up with in Irish Catholic democracy.
Now, can I just throw something in here, which is, given that, no, I think we can all agree that Jacobitism was either extinct or almost extinct by the late 18th, early 19th century. If it was, we'd be better off without it. I mean, was this an impediment to Catholics gaining, you know, equal rights and so on?
I think the best thing would have been that if the Jacobites and James could have won in the 1690s, then they'd have been all turfed out at the time of the French Revolution. They'd have all gone at once, and we'd have got rid of all of them, lock, stock, and barrel. Of course, we'd have ended up with Napoleon instead. Yeah. Where would you get, you know?
But then there might have been the French Revolution, because the French wouldn't have bankrupted themselves fighting against the British during the 18th century.
Well, there are. I
tell you what, you're all looking far too comfortable here. I think that the panel have been working far too hard, so I think it's time to bring in some contributions from the audience. Is anybody there like to ask a question? I'll ask you to use the microphone here, so hold on there. We'll come down to you. Just make sure this is on. Hello. Is that working? Is that working? Yeah. If you just give us your name.
Michael Kingannon. About 4 or 5 miles away from here. Why has the Auckland Battle site, Auckland Battlefield, the Auckland location, been literally pushed to the Battle agenda as far as development is concerned in this country? And if it is such an important site, which we know it is, why did the government decide to end their all their investment into the Boyne 2 years ago and ignore Auckland? And we are here having the most significant battle in Irish history, and I think it's a scandal and a shame, and it's a very relies on ourselves here, that we've been left with this answer, with this situation. Now, I know historians have their job to do, but in fact, they can make the case as well, that in fact, there are some things more important than others. And Ockham has suffered as a result of being ignored by all parties.
If I could suggest an answer to that, I think it's got an awful lot to do with the photo opportunities with Bertie Ahern and Ian Paisley. You know what I mean? It's the context of the Good Friday Agreement. It's, you know, Ian presenting Bertie with a Bible, which he stuffs into his pocket, and Bertie presenting Ian with a sword. It's at a particular moment, the bind is important, and that's, you know, I think it's as cynical as that.
But you can appreciate that, you see, the Good Friday business and all, there is a relatively recent origin. Predating that, Ockham has had his position has been well established, his own feet are there, and it hasn't been acted on. And the investment that would be taken needed for Ockham on the map hasn't got into it.
Is it part of the problem is that the two-head honcho was working on the battlefield, which they were at
yeah, there is,
at the point. That's the unfortunate fact, you know. I tell you, anybody else want to come in?
I would say I'm a little disappointed so far. I think people sleep here. A lot of people don't get the basic facts of the battle and how it was lost and all this. Not so much theory and various percentages of contributing to elements. So you tried, Chairman, to see that way, and you didn't succeed. So I want more about the fact itself. And possibly then, there might be more development of the fact itself.
Well, you have the floor, so you don't ask a question. By the way, I plead guilty. I picked the title, you know, because I thought it would be a more interesting discussion to discuss the legacy of Jacobitism, and we haven't finished yet, rather than the details of the battle, which are relatively well known. But if you want to ask some questions about the battle, you have the floor. That's the whole point of the experiment.
The discussion towards the ins and outs of the battle, and it's going off again back to the same old stuff.
Yes.
Pat Finn here from the village farm. Two questions, I suppose. One is just related to the latter bottom. Is there any reference that St. Ruth had when he captured by his own army, firing from behind? And secondly, if he was, his head was, how was it be possible for a cannon to get that near from where the two lines of the battle were? And secondly, just there's supposed to be a piece of regulation, supposed to be set up in the mine. And why would that be trying set that up down here often.
Richard, you want to come in on the San Roo head issue?
Yes. The cannon really didn't have to fire that far to take his head off. I doubt very much if it was blue on blue, or in this case, Grigon on Grigon. Certainly it was a Williamite cannonball. The cannon itself could have done considerable damage anywhere within about 1,000 yards, but even beyond that. And there's a classic story told of a soldier of the 27th and his skillings at Waterloo, standing in the square, where he watched a French cannonball that had bounced not once, not twice, but at least three times, and he thought it was dead, and he put his foot out to kick it, and his leg was removed below the knee. Now, there is enough kinetic energy left in it, even when it will not knock down a wall, to remove somebody's head. As simple as that.
Right, there's also a story told, an apocryphal tale, that on the Williamite side, supposedly the Dean of Raphoe was the Dean of what is the smallest city in Europe, Raphoe, was supposedly lining up his cannon to fire, and he allegedly pulled off the heel of his shoe and put it under the cannon, and that was the cannon that took San Roo's head off. So, it used to be a toast to the heel of the Dean of Raphoe, because obviously that what took the head off, but it's just a tale.
Tom Mayer, I'm a member of the Kelly Club. I just go back to the question I was raised a couple of minutes ago regarding the you know, how Ockham has been left behind in regards to the buying. So it's only the initiative that's been taken by the committee last year and proceeded with this year, with the support of the Kelly clan, that will put Ockham back on the map again. And it's like a people's initiative, isn't it? It's the people, the committee people, the ordinary people of Ockham, with the support of the Kelly clan, will actually highlight the battle again. It'll get discussions like this going again, it'll get debate going, it'll revive our history in the Battle of Ockham, and then the hierarchy will not be able to ignore what took place so many years ago. So I would say, in fact, as against being negative about it, not getting the recognition that Ockham should have got over the years, that initiatives like this will actually put it up the agenda and bring it to the fore in the future. So I think it's a brilliant initiative, and the discussion, we can all argue about what way the discussion should go and what our preference would be, but I think the initiative today is a brilliant initiative. Thank you.
Through the microphone. There's other people who want to come in. You've had your speaking your stake already. Paulie, you wanted to say something there?
Well, I think Michael was going to say the same. The thing about, I'm heartened to hear that, because you have here a battle site that is much more intact than the Battle of the Boyne site. The Battle of the Boyne site, the river's not the same, there's a canal, the old bridge isn't where it was, the Nore isn't where it was. There's practically no feature of the ground or the built environment around there that is the same. You can stand on that road and you can look down, and if you can, okay, there's a lot of one-off housing on Ockham Hill itself the past 15, 20 years, but you've got a site that's largely intact. You can still visualise to a great extent what you've got there. If you could develop, if the council could only develop a bit of land acquisition and develop a viewing point, you don't need huge development. You've got a product, if you like.
Well, I think
a stand.
When we did make the battle site visit to this site, is where Ginkgo stood. We'd make it about
that's
2 miles that way.
It is back the road towards Bandislaw.
Right, but there's a magnificent viewing point. Point is that, like, on the road to Galway, this would be a magnificent stopping off point. That if it was properly signposted, and that people could stop and view an intact landscape, because, like, what, like, I think the landscape itself, let alone the battle, is worth preserving.
My name is Colin Morrissey. Have any of you historians been able to find out more about St. Ruth? His personality is greatly obscured. The only reference I come across is St. Simon 37. Louis XIV put him to the west of Ireland because he was beating his wife when he died in a bog. But I think very little is known. Has anybody really gone into the French archives? Because if he was a lieutenant general in the French army, there must be stuff on him.
He was a dragoon officer. He was involved in the infamous Dragonades, the forceful conversion of Huguenots. He was supposed to be, reputed to be, a very ugly looking little man, and very scuffy, and a wife beater, and all of those. But why was he? I don't know why he was sent to Ireland himself and Tessa as second in command. I suspect it has to do with his experience. He had fought with Irish troops in Savoy the year before, 1690, with some of the is it 1690? Yes, that summer. So there could be that. I don't know.
And the,
there's,
and it's, Simon says that he...
Hold on.
Wait for microphone. Hold on. The actual quote from St. Simon was that he married the widow of another French marshal, I can't remember your man's name, and then he took to meeting her. But she was a relation or a friend of Madame de Maintenon, Louis XIV's later mistress, and she complained to Monsieur, which is why they referred to Louis XIV, and he told him to stop beating his wife. But according to St. Simon, evidently he had taken a liking to beating his wife because he continued to do it, whereupon Monsieur banished him to the west of Ireland where he died in the bog. It's probably also true because he decided to survive, but that's what St. Simon says.
Funny enough, I knew Hagen, but St. Ruth, that appointment, the Irish appointment, would have been well sought after. I mean, the predecessor, Lazon, wanted to be there. And so St. Ruth, that is a mark of approbation rather than the banishment. And St. Simon is colourful, very witty raconteur, but you know yourself.
Well, we don't know any more about him. He's already been very careful.
There's a PhD there.
Yeah, just to
discuss
here, I just wondering, did it move from ideology from Jacobite to Jacobite? Where did it move from the people who were politically active? Like in the 16th Party, the politically active people would have been the Irish aristocracy. Now, they were largely defeated and put to flight and land taken from them. So basically, we didn't have an Irish aristocracy for 1790 or there or thereabouts. What happened then, it seemed to have been the only political agitation would have been by, say, defenders and groups like that. We're really concentrated with a lot of time land issues. And that's how it could be established. The change of personnel facilitates the change of the ideology.
Now, I think we're back to this discussion of ideology. And just following on from your point there, notwithstanding the republicanism of Tom Davis and so on, the fact is that Irish nationalism, as it developed in the 19th century, was, to a large degree, essentially Catholic. So I just like to put it to the panel. Could it be argued that this is a comeback of Jacobitism in a different form, and in particular the Irish state, established after the treaty? To what extent was it a Jacobite state? Anybody?
No, I don't think so. Well, it's not a monarchy. It is a republic, but it's a popular republic. It's much more something much more. If you look for historical background, say to the Confederacy of the 1640s, or even the alliances of the Middle Ages, where you get two great factions, the Butlers and Geraldines, just like the way you get Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, who control patronage networks. That's what the modern democracy is, two patronage networks.
No, but many people would argue that it wasn't Republican, whatever it was.
Well, I would argue it was. I mean, if you look at the founding myths, the Irish state looks to its founding myths are grounded in the Republican tradition, 1798, through the Fenians, through the Troubles, 1916-21, which is why Ockham, funny enough, you asked, why is it marginalised? It was big in the 1890s at the time of the bicentenary, would that be right? But thereafter, it isn't part of the 20th century historical narrative. I think because it doesn't fit the story that the state is trying to write for itself, whereas the Boyne fits the story that the Boyne, Derry and Enniskillen, the Boyne fits the story of the unionist community. That's my own.
I think, notwithstanding the sort of fawning sycophancy of the Irish state in the light of Elizabeth II's visit, you know, the ethos of this state is republican. And, you know, you talked about how this site and how, and Padraig has just said how this site has been either marginalised in comparison to the Boyne. You could say the same of Scariff Hollis. I remember, I think it was 1994 or 5. I was up with Padraig at Scariff Hollis. This is one of the bloodiest battles fought on this island. There wasn't even a stone. There was nothing. So we had a symposium, and there was a monument put up. Similarly, Knocknanoose or Dungan's Hill, I doubt there is anything marking that. You know, these are hugely important and bloody battles, but they don't fit into the... No, they don't fit into the... Ben Borb sort of does because of a sort of a retrospective mythologising of Own Row O'Neill.
And they won.
Yeah, and they won, which is... that's an important point. But some fit and some don't.
But also, somebody over there was saying at the end of the Irish landed aristocracy, the new Catholic elite that grew up with the Catholic Committee and so on and so forth, they're a middle-class mercantile leadership that emerges, and so consequently they come, they're not landowning an aristocracy any longer. The Catholic bourgeoisie emerges from the Catholic Committee and so on and so forth. So consequently it isn't, there's no real interest in Catholic aristocracy. This is a sort of cul-de-sac of Irish history. This sort of Jacobinism becomes a sort of cul-de-sac. It's important and Imrok here, the far end here, is one of the men who has heroically rescued this from people who have denigrated the importance of the penal laws and the Irish regiment and the Jacobin threat and so on and so forth, which is sterling work and has yet to be recognised and given its full value. But like in the longer term, it is, you know, and as Eamon says himself now, the heritage that we now deal with is a Republican war.
Any other contributions to the floor here? Yeah.
Hello, my name is Joris and I'm out from Tariqa Cyprus. I'm just wondering, perhaps in the panel, you talk about how international the Battle of Okhrim was and the whole campaign, but there's a kind of, never it seems to be a mention of the Spanish. Do they, have they washed their hands since Kinsale, or do they follow the ongoing developments in Ireland and James' flight?
Well, Spain's out of the picture in European power politics, and like shortly after this, Spain at this point has got a king. I think he's Charles II.
Charles the Bewitched.
Yeah, who's really not capable, retarded and not capable of being king. And then you get the War of the Spanish Succession. Like Spain is on its last legs, the Habsburg monarchy in Spain is on its last legs. And that's really what ends Louis XIV's great reach for power, because he overreaches himself in trying to put the Bourbons into Spain. But Spain really is a busted flush as a European or world power at this stage. Like, in the next generation, people end up fighting over Spain. England gets Gibraltar, for instance, as a result of that war.
I'm just wondering, because...
Hold on, use the mic. Yeah.
Just the influence of young people since the flight of the Irish, because a lot of the Irish had gone there. I was just wondering where they kind of drumming up support maybe for the Irish cause at that time, because, you know, don't we have, like in the 19th century, to the O'Donnell Prime Minister, you know, the...
Sure. Well, I think Baldur O'Donnell comes back from Spain, but generally, by this stage, the Yankees center their interests in France, because basically they're pragmatic as well. Like in the early 17th century, they appealed to Spain, which is the number one power in Europe. In the second half of the 17th century, they appealed to France, because they're numero uno. Like the Irish exiles and emigres are just as pragmatic as those European powers themselves are.
Spain is actually allied with William of Orange, the Pope. It's a very simple war. It's France against everybody. Right, so that in this case, the French and Spanish, is turning history on its head. They're our enemies, but they're not actually. There's no Spanish troops, as Hiram says. They're not able to defend the Spanish Netherlands, and they alone get involved in an Irish campaign. So they're kind of irrelevant there.
Now, Annie, yeah,
Sean,
yeah. In reference to the Boyne, I think that without the Boyne, to me, it's a spearhead vehicle regarding the battlefields of Ireland, and there are many problems with them. People have many attitudes about it and opinions about it, but without it, I actually don't think that Ockham would even get any light, and I think that that's the value of it. It may have a number of things that people have difficulties with, what Eamon has said, and the various speakers, but at the end of the day, it is a spearhead project, and I think without it, this whole war and this aspect of our history, we wouldn't even have this today. We wouldn't be discussing it, and you know, as I said, there would be difficulties with it. But sure, there's difficulties with everything, and you know, that's how I would perceive it. You know, so and I work there as well, so I know we've been working.
It's definitely the case that the Boyne can be criticised as being given prominence, but on the other hand, that's the way to go. There's no doubt that it shows the way, just like the war itself.
It's a very basic question, but if you travel 50 miles in any direction from here, the landscape is practically the same as it is here. How was the site chosen for the battle?
I was going to ask that very question. How come the battle was here, Richard?
So it was on the natural route of advance from Athlone for the Williamite army. It's as simple as that. One thing you find about commanders of this era and for a long time afterwards is if you put an obstacle in their path, they'll go straight at it. More recently in military history, they'll go around it, but there are still some who will go straight at it.
Now, anybody else? Yeah.
Very simple question. In relation to Ockham, is the real importance of Ockham, the fact that one of your panel touched on earlier, the fact that it denuded Ireland of its military leaders, of its leaders in relation to, shall we say, the political environment, and those that had land, because the majority either died at Ockham or were taken prisoners, therefore they had no political power unless they converted. Thereby, if they converted, as some of our locals did, they moved into the other camp. Therefore, you had a very, very different political movement, a political class afterwards, because it didn't come from the same background.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I suppose a Scottish equivalent would be Flood. You know, the king dies and the cream of the Scottish aristocracy died around him at Flood against the old enemy, England. And that's seared into the Scottish psyche. You know, Culloden, similarly. Ockham, absolutely. You know, this is, you know, I mentioned that the numbers. You know, we can argue about the numbers, but you're talking about thousands, colossal numbers for a small country. And the fact that in 15, 20 years later, this is still a massive strain to the people who died. They know who they are. So, and then the point that Paul made about the fact that their participation, their death, their capture, deprived, you know, the Catholics of a large tranche of land upon which political power was predicated. So absolutely.
Just slightly arguing against myself, but as this conversion happens, it doesn't happen straight away. I mean, barring you've got French in Monavea, I forget his first name, that family, they become enthusiastically Whiggish and ultra-Protestant, but most of the convert families, certainly for a generation or two, are on the more, what's the word, Tory, or they're not as Whiggish, and they're more inclined to, you call it liberal later on, or even crypto-Catholic in some respects. It takes a while for that to happen.
Well, Edmund Burke was a
good idea, good example. I mean, Edmund Burke is the nephew of the Attorney General of the Jacobite regime. Am I right, or is it
Nagel.
Then his son is head of, or secretary to the Catholic Committee in the 1790s.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's the whole
gamut.
Yeah.
Now, if there are no further questions from the audience, I think I'll just go to wrap up here. I just want to throw out one thing, because it came up in relation to what Aim was saying. I mean, and the question I wanted to ask is, like, is there any lingering Jacobitism out there? And it struck me, Eamon, that maybe what you referred to as the fawning attitude of the political establishment to the visit of Queen Elizabeth II, is this a kind of a subterranean Jacobitism? By the way, I won't have a bad word said against it, because I got 2 days media work out of her visit, right? But several of us, actually. But seriously, I mean, are we all royalists? Are Eamon, perhaps?
I'll try and answer that by way of an anecdote. To referring to a person that all of us on this panel knows, Micheál Ócsorú, teaches history at Trinity. And about 3 or 4 months before Queen Elizabeth visited Ireland, Prince Albert Grimaldi of Monaco, was in Dublin. And at that time there was a 1641 exhibition being, how brilliant project to digitise the 1641 depositions. Micheál was involved in this, and he got a phone call. The person who made the call shall remain nameless, asking him would he, obviously Albert was on a loose end, asking him would he show him around the library in Trinity, and would he show him this exhibition. So Micheál looked at his diary and said, yeah, that's fine. I could fit him in on Tuesday morning, 9 o'clock to 11, whatever. So the person was delighted, and she said, that's brilliant, there's a few matters of protocol that we need to discuss. She said, and Micheál would be like myself, he's a Republican. She said...
It's also about 6 foot three.
And it's about 6 foot seven, right? She said, normally you would on first greeting, you would refer to Prince Albert as your highness and as customary to bow. To which Mayhem replied, it may have passed your notice, but we live in a republic here. I don't call anyone your highness, and I certainly don't bow. So if he's not happy to be called Albert Grimaldi, get somebody else to do it. But, you know, it's a funny story, but I've been introduced to people who are such and such Viscount this and Viscount that, or this person who deems himself Lord this. And, you know, I'm always struck with the fact we don't have an aristocracy here, and I don't call anyone Lord or Sir or, you know. And there is a hankering amongst the large, large proportion of the population of this country after, you know, aristocracy and that. And it's the same in America. And America is the mother of republics in some ways. They love the British royal family. They watch royal weddings. I don't know.
Anyone else want to come in on that, Harry? Last comment?
Did Michal do the tour, though?
No. Obviously they weren't happy that he wouldn't call him your highness.
I always refer to me himself as your highness when I meet him. It's very high. Listen, I think we'll Sean, you want to go in one last?
Yeah. Maybe
wait a minute, hold on.
Maybe it's a case of celebrity rather than true royalism that people are hankering after.
Yeah.
The last royal wedding and all the media attention.
Yeah.
That. So maybe it's possible. Maybe it's like a lot of politics. Maybe it isn't real politics or real conviction. It's self-interest and nonsense.
Yeah.
I think I'm going to wrap up there. Let me say I am mindful of some of the criticism that came from the floor there. I will say my only response to it is there will be many more head schools and there will be many more topics and you're more than welcome to come along. You know, so you know, and that's the thing. Usually these head schools, what happens is that the discussion flies in all sorts of different directions and it suggests other topics. And we all hope to live a long lives here. And I'm sure you're going to see all the people on this panel and myself again, I hope. So I'd like to thank, first of all, Eamon O'Keara, Richard Doherty, Pádraig Glenahan, Hiram Morgan. And I'd like to thank the organisers of this whole weekend for inviting us here. And I hope to see you all again. By the way, when you do subscribe to History Ireland, you'll be able to check out our website. In fact, you don't even have to subscribe to check out our website. But on there, you will find various podcasts and videos. And if you don't know how to operate these, you know, get your 12-year-old niece or nephew or daughter or whatever to show you how. It's very simple. And by the way, the proceedings here today will appear as a podcast shortly. So check that out, please. So I'd just like to thank everybody for their contribution, including the members of the audience. And we hope to all see you again. Thank you.